In his dissent, Thomas wrote, "The majority does not and cannot rest its time limitation on any evidence that the gap in credentials between black and white students is shrinking or will be gone in that time frame. No one can seriously contend, and the court does not, that the racial gap in academic credentials will disappear in 25 years. Nor is the court's holding that racial discrimination will be unconstitutional in 25 years made contingent on the gap closing in that time. Moreover, if O'Connor could legislate in this manner on affirmative action, what was to stop her colleagues from establishing codes of behavior in other areas?" The answer, of course, was that the only restraints on the judge in such circumstances are his or her conscience and savvy. And that, ultimately, is the best defense of what O'Connor did. On affirmative action, she picked a result and reached a compromise that was broadly acceptable to most Americans. There was no formal limit on her power, but O'Connor's extraordinary political instincts let her exercise her authority in a moderate way. In some basic, almost primal manner, O'Connor understood that 25 more years of racial preferences seemed the right amount of time. It is a scary prospect to consider what other justices in the court's history, including some of her contemporaries, would have done with the power that O'Connor arrogated to herself. Her judicial approach was indefensible in theory and impeccable in practice. The Michigan cases were something of a rout for the conservatives. Kennedy wrote a separate opinion in Grutter saying he, like Powell and Bakke, approved of the use of race in admissions, but the Michigan law school procedure looked too much like a quota for him to approve. Even Rehnquist avoided taking a stand on whether race could ever be considered. Only two justices, Scalia and Thomas, said directly that any use of race in admissions always violated the Constitution. Thomas, probably the nation's most famous beneficiary of affirmative action, wrote a passionate opinion denouncing the practice. He quoted the words of his hero Frederick Douglass, "What I ask for the Negro is not benevolence, not pity, not sympathy, but simply justice. The American people have always been anxious to know what they shall do with us. All I ask is, give him a chance to stand on his own legs. Let him alone." For all its rhetorical power, Thomas's opinion represented only a fringe view on the court and in the nation at large. Among the justices, especially Kennedy and O'Connor, the post-Bush v. Gore move to the left continued, and to some extent accelerated after Grutter. Even Rehnquist almost brought what remained of his own federalism revolution to a close. He wrote the opinion in Nevada v. Hibbs, which upheld the authority of Congress to pass the Family and Medical Leave Act of 1993, a central accomplishment of the Clinton administration. Then, in a complex series of cases, the court struck down state and then federal criminal sentencing guidelines against the wishes of the Bush administration. By a 7-2 vote, it overturned the Child Pornography Prevention Act, which made it a crime to create or possess virtual pornography, which used enhanced computer imaging rather than actual children. Even in several major criminal cases, the court sided with the defendant and overturned convictions. After 2000, the majority in Bush v. Gore, Rehnquist, O'Connor, Scalia, Kennedy, and Thomas, might have taken full control of the court, but something close to the opposite took place. Their coalition crumbled. In the 2002 term, only 5 of the 14 5-4 decisions were decided by the bloc that prevailed in Bush v. Gore. In the 2003 term, it was 9 of 19. In 2004, it was 4 of 22 such cases. At first, it was the legacy of Bush v. Gore that turned O'Connor and Kennedy towards their more liberal colleagues. Later, it was the Bush administration itself. The burst of confidence in the military and in the Bush administration following the invasion of Iraq in the spring of 2003 was short-lived. A month after the argument in Grutter, on an aircraft carrier off the coast of San Diego, the president addressed a cheering crowd before a banner that read, "Mission Accomplished." But almost from that moment, the fortunes of the American occupation turned. A determined guerrilla insurgency killed more than 3,000 American service members. Many thousands more Iraqis died. elections were held, a constitution was passed, and a new government was established, but the American experience in Iraq turned out to be considerably more difficult than it had initially appeared. And just as the war turned sour, the first cases growing out of the administration's broader war on terrorism reached the Supreme Court. They concerned an idyllic stretch of Caribbean coastline known as Guantanamo Bay. After American and Cuban forces evicted the Spanish from Cuba in 1898, the United States military remained on 45 square miles along the southern coast of the island. The American presence became official with a treaty signed by the two nations in 1903, setting the annual rent at $4,085. To this day, the American government offers payment to the Cuban government every year, but during the four decades that Fidel Castro has been in power, his government has not accepted it. The war in Afghanistan created an unprecedented level of activity at Guantanamo Bay and gave it international notoriety. On January 11, 2002, the military began moving prisoners there from Afghanistan, and all the armed forces, not just the Navy, were asked to run Joint Task Force Guantanamo. In a press conference that same day, Donald Rumsfeld, the Secretary of Defense, said that the prisoners were unlawful combatants who do not have any rights under the Geneva Convention. Among the rights granted by the Geneva Conventions is the right to an individual hearing to determine the status of each prisoner. A chorus of international condemnation, from the United Nations, the European Union, and the Organization of American States, among others, cried out against the American government. But within the United States, in the fevered aftermath of the September 11th attacks, the Guantanamo Detention and Interrogation Facility drew little notice and less controversy, at first. The prisoners at Guantanamo, who eventually numbered about 600, were mostly accused al-Qaeda members picked up on battlefields in Afghanistan and neighboring countries. The worst of the worst, as one American official put it. The notion that such despised and dangerous individuals might be able to challenge their incarceration in an American courtroom initially seemed close to outlandish. They were held in a foreign country. They were virtually incommunicado, limited to a single letter to a family member. They were allowed no visitors. But in early 2002, the family of an Australian national named David Hicks, who was being held in Guantanamo, reached out to lawyers at the Center for Constitutional Rights in New York, who agreed to file a lawsuit. It was no coincidence that the CCR, which stands well to the left of the American Civil Liberties Union in the spectrum of liberal legal interest groups, chose to challenge the American detention policy. In the early stages of the suit, the lawyers in charge could not have differed more from those directing the Michigan effort on affirmative action, with its roster of retired generals, corporate leaders, and a former Republican president. Led by a Minneapolis lawyer named Joseph Margolies, the CCR team sought assistance from several major Washington lawyers and law firms and were turned down by all. Guantanamo seemed nearly a fringe cause. But as the case moved through the federal courts and the near hysteria of the September 11th aftermath faded, the claims for the Guantanamo prisoners looked more plausible. The Bush administration had created an unusual legal category for those held on the American base. They were not criminal defendants subject to the protections of the U.S. Constitution, but neither were they prisoners of war, whose treatment had long been governed by the Geneva Conventions. Rather, the Guantanamo detainees were labeled enemy combatants who could be held and interrogated until the war on terror was over, that is, indefinitely. One reason the military refused to treat the Guantanamo detainees as POWs was because under the conventions, such prisoners may not be interrogated. And Guantanamo was designed from the start as an interrogation facility, where prisoners could be questioned in total isolation day after day and month after month without outside interference or knowledge. Furthermore, the government asserted in response to the CCR lawsuit, the plaintiffs had no right even to file a case. Because the detainees were non-American citizens held in Cuba, and that nation had ultimate sovereignty over the base, the lawsuit was the equivalent of a foreigner's filing a case from an overseas battlefield, something that American courts never allowed. The lower courts agreed and ultimately dismissed the case, which came to be known as Rasul v. Bush. Ironically, Shafiq Rasul himself was among the first prisoners released from Guantanamo, well before the case reached the Supreme Court. Still, his name remained as lead plaintiff. Two related cases concerning unlimited detention within the United States of American citizens named Yasser Hamdi and Jose Padilla worked their way toward the court at the same time. After the Supreme Court granted cert in Rasul, Hamdi, and Padilla in early 2004, the Bush administration began to take the cases more seriously. At last, after 2 years, it allowed Hamdi and Padilla to meet with their lawyers. Secretary Rumsfeld announced that the military was creating administrative review boards to evaluate the status of each prisoner in Guantanamo. The procedures gave the detainees no right to counsel, no right to confront witnesses against them, and no right of appeal, but they allowed administration lawyers to say that the government was at least doing something to assess whether the detainee deserved to remain in custody. The government also asserted that the prisoners had no right even to this meager procedural safeguard. It had been provided, quote, solely as a matter of discretion and does not confer any right or obligation enforceable by law, unquote. Mostly the Bush position remained unchanged, that the war on terror meant that the Guantanamo prisoners deserved no rights or even a day in an American courtroom. The Bush legal team, led by Ted Olson, the Solicitor General, brought the same moral certainty to the Supreme Court that the Republican political operation put forth to voters. The issues were straightforward, the choices binary. The United States or the terrorists, right or wrong. Standing up to argue in Rasul, Olson laid the same kind of choice before the court. Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. The United States is at war, Olson began with heavy portent. It is in that context that petitioners ask this court to assert jurisdiction that is not authorized by Congress, does not arise from the Constitution, has never been exercised by this court. But if this kind of talk was intended to intimidate the justices, as it cowed so many others, the tactic did not work. Indeed, it backfired. Mr. Olson, supposing the war has ended, Stevens jumped in. Could you continue to detain these people on Guantanamo? Of course we could, said Olson. In other words, the military could detain Rasul and the others whether or not there was a war. The existence of the war is really irrelevant to the legal issue, Stevens said. Olson replied weakly, it's not irrelevant because it is in this context that the question is raised. But your position does not depend on the existence of a war, Stevens insisted, and Olson had to concede it did not. So in just the first moments of the argument, Stevens had shown that the Bush administration was not claiming some temporary accommodation, but rather a permanent expansion of its power for all time in war and peace. And Stevens was showing further that Olson's rhetorical flourish, we are at war, was nothing more than posturing. The following week, on April 28th, the Hamdi and Padilla cases were argued, and again the administration put forth its view of unchecked executive authority. Jose Padilla, an American citizen, had been arrested at O'Hare Airport in Chicago and held indefinitely on suspicion of ties to Al-Qaeda. According to the Justice Department, even though Padilla was an American citizen held on American soil, he had no right to challenge his incarceration, even if he wound up being imprisoned for the rest of his life. Paul Clement, the Deputy Solicitor General, asserted to the justices that Congress's authorization of the, quote, use of all necessary and appropriate force, unquote, following the September 11th attacks, justified the unlimited detention of Padilla. In Clement's view, the courts had no right to stop or even hold a hearing about Padilla's incarceration because he was classified as an enemy combatant. In response, Ginsburg asked a far-fetched hypothetical question to test the limits of the government's position. What inhibits it? If the law is what the executive says it is, whatever is necessary and appropriate in the executive's judgment, so what is it that would be a check against torture? Well, first of all, there are treaty obligations, Clement said. But the primary check is that just as in every other war, if a U.S. military person commits a war crime by creating some atrocity on a harmless detained enemy combatant or a prisoner of war, that violates our own conception of what's a war crime and will put that U.S. military officer on trial in a court-martial. But Ginsburg pursued the issue. Suppose the executive says, mild torture we think will help get this information. It's not a soldier who's done something against the code of military justice, but it's an executive command. Some systems do that to get information. Well, Clement replied, his voice touched with a hint of indignation, our executive doesn't. Just 8 hours later, on the evening of the arguments in Hamdi and Padilla, the CBS News program 60 Minutes 2 broadcast photographs of U.S. Army personnel documenting physical and sexual abuse of prisoners at Abu Ghraib prison. The photographs, which immediately became symbols of the war, showed U.S. soldiers posing beside naked Iraqi prisoners stacked in a human pyramid, as well as a prisoner who was forced to stand on a box, his head covered by a hood, and electric wires apparently attached to his body. CBS executives had withheld the report for 2 weeks at the request of Army officials, but went ahead with the broadcast when they learned that The New Yorker was planning a report on the subject by Seymour Hersh. The magazine story was released on May 1st. As Margulies, the lawyer for Rasul and other Guantanamo detainees, recalled afterwards, these photos proved to be the most powerful amicus brief of all. The Abu Ghraib disclosure set off several months of intense public attention to the issue of torture by American personnel in Iraq and Guantanamo. The investigations revealed extensive abuse of prisoners in Iraq by low-level military personnel, but, more importantly, considerable support for torture at the highest levels of the Bush administration. While the justices were preparing their opinions in Rasul, Hamdi, and Padilla in June 2004, the most sensational document on the subject came to light, the torture memo. In the summer of 2002, Alberto R. Gonzalez, then the White House counsel, had asked the Justice Department to research the question of whether U.S. personnel involved in the war on terror were constrained by the federal anti-torture statute, which bans cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment either inside or outside the United States. The response came on August 1, 2002, from Jay Bybee and John Yoo, two senior officials who gave a virtually unrecognizably narrow definition of torture, which the law said was severe physical or mental pain and suffering. To these lawyers, physical pain amounting to torture must be equivalent in intensity to the pain accompanying serious physical injury, such as organ failure, impairment of bodily function, or even death. For purely mental pain or suffering to amount to torture, it must result in significant psychological harm of significant duration, e.g., lasting for months or even years. What was more, Bybee and you said, the president had inherent authority to overrule the statute and direct any interrogation technique that he believed was necessary. By the time the torture memo was released, Bybee had already been confirmed to a federal appellate judgeship, and you had returned to a professorship at the law school of the University of California at Berkeley. You had been a law clerk to Thomas, and several other former Thomas clerks had also played important roles in formulating the Bush administration's legal justifications for the war on terror. It is too simplistic to say that the disclosures about Abu Ghraib and torture policy determined the outcome of the Supreme Court's rulings in the three terrorism cases. But it is surely true that the news had an impact. In any event, the cases turned into humiliating defeats for the administration. In Rasul, the main case, the court ruled 6-3 that the Guantanamo detainees did have the right to challenge their incarceration in a U.S. district court. In Hamdi, the court again ruled 6-3 that the government could not prevent an American citizen from challenging his or her detention in federal court. In Padilla, the court gave the administration a purely procedural victory, ruling only that the plaintiff should have brought his case in South Carolina instead of New York. Stevens may have given the Lawrence case to Kennedy and Grutter to O'Connor, but he wasn't giving the Rasul assignment away. As for so many other men of his generation, the defining event of Stevens' youth was his service in World War II. Stevens had been raised in comfortable circumstances. His family built and ran the Stevens Hotel, a block-long Chicago landmark that was later renamed the Hilton Chicago. Stevens graduated from the University of Chicago, Phi Beta Kappa, in 1941, and planned to go to graduate school to study Shakespeare. But on the eve of American involvement in the war, several of his professors were working as talent spotters for the Navy, and they prevailed on him to sign up. Stevens did on December 6, 1941, allowing him to joke that his enlistment prompted the attack on Pearl Harbor the following day. Stevens served in the Pacific for 4 years on the staff of Admiral Chester Nimitz and won a Bronze Star. He did intelligence work, helping to break Japanese codes, and in later years often spoke of pride in his service. His intense patriotism prompted the most out-of-character vote of his judicial career when he sided with the conservatives in the famous flag-burning case of 1989. In his dissent in that case, Stevens said the burning of the flag was not protected by the First Amendment, because it is more than a proud symbol of the courage, the determination, and the gifts of nature that transformed 13 fledgling colonies into a world power. It is a symbol of freedom, of equal opportunity, of religious tolerance, and of goodwill for other peoples who share our aspirations. Stevens did not presume that his own service as an intelligence officer in World War II gave him the wisdom to second-guess the Bush officials' conduct of intelligence operations at Guantanamo, but his military experience, combined with his quiet self-confidence, made him harder to intimidate on the subject of military necessity. Many of the darkest moments in the history of the court took place when the justices deferred too much to the purported expertise of the executive branch on matters of national security. During and after World War I, the court upheld several dubious prosecutions of political dissidents on the ground that their advocacy put the nation in danger. Most notoriously, during World War II, the justices upheld the exclusion of American citizens of Japanese ancestry from the West Coast in Korematsu v. United States. Fred Korematsu himself submitted an amicus brief in support of Rasul. Stevens knew that history and was determined not to replay it. And the disclosures that took place while the cases were pending about Abu Ghraib and the torture memo made the credibility of the administration's representations to the court much more suspect. Suddenly, it was the Bush administration itself, not the plaintiff's leftist lawyers, that looked outside the mainstream of legal and political opinion. For a court majority determined never to stray too far from what the public believed, that change was crucial. So, it turned out, was the preposterousness of the administration's key argument in Rasul. Olson had maintained that the Navy base in Guantanamo was really Cuban soil, and to allow a lawsuit there was inviting litigation on a foreign battlefield. But as Stevens put it in his opinion, by the express terms of its agreements with Cuba, the United States exercises complete jurisdiction and control over Guantanamo Bay Naval Base, and may continue to exercise such control permanently if it so chooses. The entire reason that the military took the detainees to such a remote outpost was because the base offered total freedom from outside interference. Allowing lawyers to visit prisoners in Guantanamo and letting them conduct litigation offered no risk at all of escape or disruption, something that could not be said for many prisons within the United States. Even Scalia's dissent, which was joined by Rehnquist and Thomas, could not work up much passion on the issue. The reason for Scalia's relative reticence became apparent in Hamdi, which was handed down the same day as Rasul. There, the repudiation of Bush's position was even more complete, and the author of the majority opinion was O'Connor, that reliable vector for the views of most Americans. Her opinion was scathing, a testament to her growing estrangement from the Bush administration. Her impatience with pious lectures on national security was palpable. Quote, "It is during our most challenging and uncertain moments that our nation's commitment to due process is most severely tested, and it is in those times that we must preserve our commitment at home to the principles for which we fight abroad," unquote. O'Connor had become an evangelist for the cause of judicial independence and she used Hamdi to remind the administration that this court, her court, would never become a rubber stamp. Quote, "The position that the courts must forego any examination of the individual case and focus exclusively on the legality of the broader detention scheme cannot be mandated by any reasonable view of separation of powers, as this approach serves only to condense power into a single branch of government. We have long since made clear that a state of war is not a blank check for the president when it comes to the rights of the nation's citizens," unquote. If there was any doubt about what O'Connor meant, she waved the bloody shirt of one of the worst moments in the court's history by citing Korematsu itself to drive her point home. Remarkably, O'Connor's view was the moderate one on the court. She said that Hamdi could not be detained without a hearing of some kind, but that he did not necessarily have to receive the full protections afforded a criminal defendant. Scalia, of all people, wrote a dissenting opinion, joined by Stevens, an unfamiliar bedfellow, saying that the Bush administration's entire concept of detention of enemy combatants was unconstitutional for American citizens. Scalia said O'Connor had been too soft on the Bush administration, arguing that Hamdi should be charged with a federal crime or released immediately. Quote, "The proposition that the executive lacks indefinite wartime detention authority over its citizens is consistent with the founders' general mistrust of military power permanently at the executive's disposal," unquote. Scalia, the originalist, added, "Whatever the general merits of the view that war silences law or modulates its voice, that view has no place in the interpretation and application of a constitution designed precisely to confront war and in a manner that accords with democratic principles to accommodate it." Only a single justice, Thomas, accepted the administration's position. On November 2, 2004, George W. Bush won a narrow victory over John Kerry, and this time the president needed no assistance from the Supreme Court. If Bush had lost, he would have joined Jimmy Carter as the only presidents in American history to serve full terms without having had the chance to make an appointment to the court. But on the eve of the election, it was announced that Chief Justice Rehnquist was ill with thyroid cancer. Now it appeared Bush would soon have the opportunity he'd hoped for. 2 months later, the world saw William Rehnquist for the first time since his illness had been announced. On January 20, 2005, Rehnquist made an unsteady journey down the platform steps in front of the Capitol to administer the oath of office to George W. Bush. With his administrative assistant, Sally Ryder, closely monitoring his procession, Rehnquist arrived well after his colleagues and the other guests had taken their places. Chemotherapy had reduced his hair to a few wisps, and a tracheotomy tube made his voice hard to hear, but the chief had the fortitude to complete his duty. No one studied the chief more carefully than the other eight justices. Only Stevens and O'Connor had been allowed to make brief visits to his home. The others had not seen him at all. Rehnquist listened to tapes of the oral arguments, cast his votes by memo, and continued to make assignments from home. In his absence, Stevens presided over the conferences and the oral arguments. Even in good health, Rehnquist preferred to communicate by memo with all but his immediate staff, so the court functioned normally even though he was not on the premises. Rehnquist had a strong sense of responsibility about his obligations, and he was meticulous about making sure that the court did not suffer from his illness. He gave no hint if he was thinking of resigning. As in most other terms, the justices disposed of the easy cases in the first few months. Year in and year out, about 40% of the court's opinions have been unanimous, and many more draw just a mild dissent or two. During the first months of Rehnquist's absence, the court did a pretty good job of avoiding controversy, with the single exception of Kennedy's opinion in Roper v. Simmons, which invoked foreign law in striking down the death penalty for juvenile offenders. The case had been argued on the morning of October 13th, Rehnquist's last day on the bench, and the decision was handed down on March 1st. The chief, silent once more in a major case, one that amounted to yet another demonstration that the court's center of gravity had moved to the left, joined Scalia's dissent. O'Connor and Kennedy were the chief beneficiaries of this ideological shift, as they controlled the outcome of more cases and won assignments from Stevens for such opinions as Lawrence, Grutter, and Hamdi. During the spring of 2005, when the justices looked for clues about Rehnquist's prognosis, the most important event for the court involved a case that was never accepted for review. The justices did not write a single opinion in the matter of Terry Schiavo, but no case that year had a greater impact on the court as an institution. By the beginning of 2005, Schiavo's story was a familiar one in Florida, if not in the rest of the country. She became suddenly ill on February 25, 1990, and her heart briefly stopped beating, and she went into a deep coma. In 1998, her husband and guardian, Michael Schiavo, went to the state court in Florida asking that her feeding tube be removed because she was in a persistent vegetative state. Michael said that based on conversations with his wife before she was stricken, he believed she would not have wanted to be kept alive in such circumstances. A judge agreed and ordered the tube removed. But Terry's parents, Robert and Mary Schindler, argued that her condition was not so dire and that she might someday recover. Years of bitter court fights followed. The struggle over Terry Schiavo was at once a terrible family quarrel and a proxy battle over abortion and the right to life. It was also, curiously, a recapitulation of the struggle in Bush v. Gore in Florida. Throughout the process, the more Democratic-leaning courts in the state found in Michael Schiavo's favor, and the Republican-dominated state legislature, along with Governor Jeb Bush, took the parents' side. In 2003, the state even passed a law requiring that Terry's feeding tube be reinserted, and the state Supreme Court, the same justices who had ruled twice in Gore's favor, declared that law unconstitutional. The final crisis in the case was set off when a Florida judge, George Greer, ruled on February 25, 2005, that he would permit no more stays and ordered the tube removed on March 18th. In front of the hospice in Pinellas Park, where Schiavo was being treated, a series of protests and prayer vigils began under the leadership of Reverend Patrick Mahoney, who was affiliated with a group called the Christian Defense Coalition. Mahoney was a veteran of the anti-abortion movement and many conservative causes. In 1994, he had persuaded Paula Jones to file her sexual harassment lawsuit against Bill Clinton. Schiavo's feeding tube was removed on the afternoon of March 18th. With their options in Florida exhausted and Terry likely to die in a few days, Schiavo's parents turned to Washington, specifically to Tom DeLay, the majority leader in the House of Representatives. An ardent opponent of abortion rights and a fierce partisan known as the Hammer, DeLay engineered an extraordinary legislative feat with remarkable speed. Congress had gone into recess, but DeLay managed to gather a quorum of 218 representatives on Sunday, March 20th, to pass a bill designed to prevent the removal of Schiavo's feeding tube. The Senate followed suit. President Bush cut short a vacation at his Crawford, Texas ranch to fly across the country to sign the bill, which he did at 1:08 a.m. on Monday, March 21st. Later that day, Bush said, "It is wisest to always err on the side of life." By its specific terms, the law, known formally as For the Relief of the Parents of Teresa Marie Schiavo Act, instructed the Federal District Court in Florida to give the case yet another hearing relating to the withholding or withdrawal of food, fluids, or medical treatment to sustain her life. The law further stated that the district court shall entertain and determine the suit without delay. So on the very day the law was signed, Judge James D. Whitmore held a hearing in Tampa on the case, and the next day he rejected the Schindler's attempt to reinsert the feeding tube. The parents appealed to the 11th Circuit and then to the U.S. Supreme Court, which on March 24th refused to intervene. By this time, the case had been considered by 19 judges in six state and federal courts, and between 2001 and 2005, the U.S. Supreme Court had declined to hear the case five times. Terry Schiavo died on March 31st. Her death only increased the rhetorical fervor. On the day of her death, DeLay threatened to impeach the judges who had presided over her case, including the Supreme Court justices. "The time will come for the men responsible for this to answer for their behavior," DeLay said. "We will look at an unaccountable, out-of-control judiciary that thumbed their nose at Congress and the president." 3 days later, Senator John Cornyn, a Republican from Texas, made an even more incendiary statement. Just weeks earlier, there had been a pair of horrific attacks on judges and their families. In Chicago, a deranged litigant before federal judge Joan Lefkoe broke into her home and murdered her husband and mother. And in Atlanta, a defendant in a rape case killed the judge in his trial and two others in the course of an escape attempt. In a speech on the Senate floor, Cornett suggested the attacks on the judges might have taken place because of decisions like Schiavo. Quote, "I don't know if there is a cause and effect connection, but we have seen some recent episodes of courthouse violence in this country," Cornett said. "I wonder whether there may be some connection between the perception in some quarters, on some occasions, where judges are making political decisions, yet are unaccountable to the public, that it builds up and builds up and builds up to the point where some people engage in violence." The justices watch these developments, the litigation, the frenzied rush to pass a law for Schiavo's purported benefit, the venomous attacks on the judges, with consternation. The assaults on the judges, and Cornyn's ugly reference to them, left a particularly strong impression because, unbeknownst to the public, both O'Connor and Ginsburg had also received death threats. One of the messages, which was posted in a web chat room, said, "Okay, commandos, here's your first patriotic assignment, an easy one. Supreme Court Justices Ginsburg and O'Connor have publicly stated that they use foreign laws and rulings to decide how to rule on American cases. This is a huge threat to our republic and constitutional freedom. If you are what you say you are, and not armchair patriots, then those two justices will not live another week." Ginsburg, with her mordant view of human nature, shrugged the whole thing off. O'Connor did not. To her, the Schiavo case marked only the latest outrage from the extremist who she believed had hijacked her beloved Republican Party. The hiring of John Ashcroft, the politicized response to the affirmative action case, the lawless approach to the war on terror, and the accelerating disaster of the war in Iraq all appalled O'Connor. But in O'Connor's list of grievances against Republicans in general, and Bush in particular, the Schiavo case was the worst. O'Connor's radar for the political center worked flawlessly in the Schiavo controversy. Though members of Congress in both parties thought they were doing the public's bidding by scrambling to pass the Schiavo bill, polls revealed widespread revulsion at the way Washington intervened in the family tragedy. Around 70% of the public disapproved of Bush's and Congress's handling of the Schiavo matter. According to polls, most people objected to the Schiavo legislation for the same reason majorities generally supported women's right to choose abortion, that the decision was one for individuals and families, not the government. This view appealed to O'Connor's libertarian streak, but the core of her outrage had a different source. To O'Connor, the real danger was the idea that with this law, Congress was trying to dictate to the courts how they should rule. In other words, worse than telling a family what to do was telling judges what to do. She saw the threat to judicial independence not in some far-off third-world capital, but in the one across First Street from her own office. Bush and his allies were undermining the separation of powers in the war on terror, ignoring the rule of law in Guantanamo, and undermining judges in Florida. And O'Connor wasn't going to watch in silence as it happened. Later in 2005, she took her indignation on the road, giving fiery speeches on the subject of judicial independence. O'Connor's foes weren't backing down either. On April 7th, Tom DeLay told a conservative conference in Washington entitled "Confronting the Judicial War on Faith" that judicial independence does not equal judicial supremacy. Speakers at that conference advocated mass impeachment, stripping the courts of jurisdiction to hear certain cases, and using Congress's budgetary authority to punish offending judges. O'Connor fired right back at DeLay, noting in a speech to an appellate lawyers association that this was after the Terry Schiavo case, when the federal courts applied Congress's one-time-only statute as it was written, but alas, perhaps not how the congressman wished it was written, O'Connor said. It gets worse, O'Connor went on. In all the federal courts, death threats have become increasingly common. Taking aim at Senator Cornyn, she said, it does not help when a high-profile senator, after noting that decisions he sees as activist cause him great distress, suggests there may be a cause-and-effect connection between such activism and the recent episodes of courthouse violence in this country. The threats were not an abstract issue for O'Connor. In this very month, April 2005, just weeks after the malicious comments in the chat room, each of the justices was sent homemade cookies containing lethal doses of rat poison. The packages were intercepted before they reached the justices' chambers. The woman who sent them, Barbara Joan March of Bridgeport, Connecticut, also sent poison to several executive branch officials. The next year, March was sentenced to 15 years in prison. Following the Cornyn and DeLay remarks, the episode left O'Connor feeling the judiciary was under siege. In her final year on the court, O'Connor advocated vigorously for the system that made possible all that she had done. Only an independent Supreme Court kept the government tethered to the core values of the Constitution. To O'Connor, the fight for judicial independence had never been more important, because she and her cause now had powerful adversaries, the political party she had once loved and the president she had once installed in office. For all the challenges she faced, it was still a great time in O'Connor's life. She was a healthy 75-year-old woman working in a job that she adored, one that had given her the chance to be the most important woman in American history. She reviled the current administration, but she had the world's best platform to speak out against its abuses. She was more influential than ever, the critical vote on issue after issue, and she reveled in that responsibility. In Breyer, O'Connor had found a true friend and ally, her first since Powell left the bench many years earlier. But as the months passed in 2005, O'Connor did not have the chance to savor her good fortune. After a period of some stability, her husband's health was again declining. John did not take well to her move to the second floor chambers. Worse, he began to exhibit one of the most heartbreaking symptoms of Alzheimer's disease, a penchant to wander. If he was not watched at all times, John simply left her chambers. Several times, court personnel tracked him down just before he got outside, where he could have been lost, injured, or worse. Even with all the resources available to a Supreme Court justice, the situation was becoming unmanageable. Speculation about her retirement had been incessant. O'Connor enjoyed public attention and sought publicity, but only on her own terms. Aware that reporters would ask her friends and colleagues if they knew about her plans, she never discussed the subject with them. O'Connor said little even to her three sons about what she should do. But by the end of the court's term in June 2005, there really wasn't much to debate. She had not outsourced her boy's upbringing, she said, and she was not going to outsource John's care either. On July 1st, O'Connor sent her letter of resignation to President Bush. Few people paid attention to the text of her letter, but O'Connor had crafted the message with care. "Dear President Bush, this is to inform you of my decision to retire, effective upon the nomination and confirmation of my successor. It has been a great privilege indeed to have served as a member of the court for 24 terms. I will leave it with enormous respect for the integrity of the court and its role under our constitutional structure. Sincerely, Sandra Day O'Connor." It was, in O'Connor's polite way, a direct shot at Bush and a plea for the cause that obsessed her in her final days on the bench. She was determined to protect the court's role under our constitutional structure precisely against the incursions that she thought Bush and his allies were attempting to make. But few people noticed. O'Connor discovered quickly that retirement brought fulsome tributes, but also immediate irrelevance. One moment she was the swing vote on the Supreme Court, and the next, it seemed, she was a display piece in a museum. She had lost her job, and the political party that was her home had lost her. Worst of all, she was losing her husband. In those first days after her announcement, she didn't answer the phone too often. She sat in her office and cried. Part 4. The planning for this moment, the opportunity for George W. Bush to nominate a justice to the Supreme Court, had begun shortly after Election Day in 2000. At the time, with Florida still undecided, it was not even clear that Bush would become president, but his team wanted to be ready with a nominee as soon as there was a vacancy. the transformation of the court would be a central priority of the new administration if Bush had the chance. Now he had that chance, and the man he'd name was John G. Roberts, Jr. of the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. John Roberts was not genetically engineered to be a justice of the Supreme Court, but it often seemed that way. His career trajectory was so smooth, his progress so steady, his reputation so exalted, his personality so winning, that he seemed at times preternaturally favored for that ultimate destination. Roberts was born in Buffalo on January 27, 1955, and raised in Indiana and Illinois, where his father was an executive in the steel industry. Young John was captain of his high school football team and the best student in his high school class. In 1976, he graduated from Harvard College, summa cum laude. 3 years later, he received his degree magna cum laude from Harvard Law School, where he was managing editor of the Law Review. His colleagues on the review included Justice Ginsburg's daughter, Jane. Both the college and the law school still bore the scars of the politically tumultuous 1960s, but Roberts managed to excel without making enemies, a skill that would serve him well. His first judicial clerkship was with Henry J. Friendly, a legendary judge on the Second Circuit, whose chambers in New York were a frequent destination for especially cerebral graduates of Harvard Law. Friendly came out of the moderate Republican tradition that included such judges as Learned Hand and John Marshall Harlan II, who were Souter's great inspirations on the bench. Roberts decided his future was in Washington, not New York, and he moved to the Capitol just in time to join the Reagan Revolution. He arrived in William Rehnquist's chambers as a law clerk in the summer of 1980, when the young associate justice was a relative outsider on a Supreme Court that was still dominated by the liberal William Brennan. But conservatives were ascending, and Roberts thrived. After his clerkship, he spent 4 years in the office of Reagan's White House counsel, where he earned a reputation for brilliance and good humor. His plain-spoken memos, preserved in the Reagan Presidential Library, display wit, common sense, and conservative politics in equal measure. For example, regarding a proposal by Chief Justice Warren Burger to lighten the workload of the Supreme Court by the creation of a new intermediate appeals court above the existing circuit courts, Robert made this tart observation. While some of the tales of woe emanating from the court are enough to bring tears to the eyes, it is true that only Supreme Court justices and school children are expected to and do take the entire summer off. With perfect timing, Roberts left the Reagan White House shortly before the administration nearly imploded in the Iran-Contra scandal, and he established himself as a successful appellate litigator at the distinguished Washington firm of Hogan & Hartson. With the election of the first President Bush in 1988, Roberts returned to government, this time as the principal deputy to Solicitor General Kenneth Starr. Roberts' easy manner, combined with his vast intellect, made him a favorite of the justices, and he ultimately came to argue 39 cases, far more than any nominee in the court's recent history. Such was Roberts' reputation that in 1992, at only 37, he was nominated to the D.C. Circuit. Then, for the first time in his life, Roberts came up against something he couldn't overcome. The Democrats who controlled the Senate sensed victory in November and essentially shut down the confirmation process. Even then, Roberts looked like Supreme Court material, so the Democrats were especially pleased to block his promising judicial career. With Bush's defeat in 1992, Roberts returned to Hogan & Hartson and, in all likelihood, a career of gilded obscurity in corporate law. Roberts' failure to win confirmation to the D.C. Circuit in 1992 turned out to be a lucky break. For the next 8 years, he developed perhaps the best Supreme Court practice in the United States, mostly representing large corporations in business disputes with one another or with the government. Almost every year, Roberts had several arguments before the justices, and he also filed a steady stream of cert petitions and amicus briefs. Not incidentally, he also made about $1 million a year. Roberts generally steered clear of the political controversies of the Clinton years, declining to participate in any investigations of the White House, and refusing even to become a prominent talking head about impeachment. his contribution to Bush's legal strategy in the Florida recount was important but low profile. A natural reticence and skill at avoiding enemies kept him largely out of public view. Still, among his former colleagues in Republican politics and law, Roberts retained a golden aura, even without having established a public record of partisanship. Miguel Estrada, a prominent Washington lawyer and nominee for the D.C. Circuit himself, used to advise young lawyers coming out of the Solicitor General's office, "Go work for John G. Roberts. The G is for God." If Roberts had been confirmed in 1992, of course, he would have amassed an extensive paper trail of controversial decisions on the D.C. Circuit by the time George W. Bush took office in 2001. Instead, Roberts had only enhanced his reputation by excelling as an advocate. Again, once Democrats established control of the Judiciary Committee in the middle of 2001, they tried to stall Roberts' second nomination as they did his first 9 years earlier. But the Republicans retook control of the Senate in 2002, and Orrin Hatch, now chairman of the Judiciary Committee, promptly moved Roberts' nomination through the process early the following year. On May 8, 2003, he was confirmed by the full Senate on a voice vote without opposition. Before Roberts had even taken his seat as a federal appeals court judge, his friends in the White House counsel's office started compiling the dossier that put him on the short list for the Supreme Court. After some discussion within the administration, on July 19, 2005, President Bush called Roberts and offered him the seat that Sandra Day O'Connor was vacating. Roberts' wife and two children joined the president at the White House for dinner at 7 o'clock, and at 9 o'clock, in the East Room on live television, Bush introduced Roberts to the nation. With his two children scampering nearby, his son Jack in short pants acting out Spider-Man moves, Roberts spoke as the best Supreme Court advocates always do, without notes. "Thank you, Mr. President," he said. "Thank you very much. It is both an honor and very humbling to be nominated to serve on the Supreme Court. Before I became a judge, my law practice consisted largely of arguing cases before the court. That experience left me with a profound appreciation for the role of our court in our constitutional democracy and a deep regard for the court as an institution. I always got a lump in my throat whenever I walked up those marble steps to argue a case before the court, and I don't think it was just from the nerves. I am very grateful for the confidence the president has shown in nominating me, and I look forward to the next step in the process before the United States Senate." He concluded by thanking his family and acknowledging his children, who remind me every day why it's so important for us to work to preserve the institutions of our democracy. Any doubts about Roberts' confirmation, to the extent there ever were any, vanished that evening. His obvious intelligence, abundant qualifications, and even his wholesome good looks would have made sustained opposition difficult. Within a day of the Roberts choice, Republican moderates were saying that his nomination did not constitute extraordinary circumstances justifying a filibuster. More importantly, Democratic moderates agreed. As Senator Joseph Lieberman said, "This is a credible nominee and not one that, as far as we know now, has a record that could in any sense be described as extremist." With 55 Republicans in the Senate and a filibuster effectively off the table, Roberts could expect to cruise to confirmation. His hearings were set to begin on Tuesday, September 6th, the day after Labor Day. Rehnquist had surprised almost everyone by not resigning on the last day of the term in June. His voice had been raspy and his tracheotomy tube was still in place, but his good humor that day suggested he might be holding the disease at bay. He had told O'Connor that he wanted to serve one more year, and that seemed plausible if not exactly realistic. But the chief's health had declined over the summer. Anaplastic thyroid carcinoma is an especially virulent cancer. It is rare for patients to live longer than a year after diagnosis, and Rehnquist by summer had passed the 8-month mark. Still, his dry humor remained intact. When asked on his final visit to the emergency room who his primary care physician was, the chief muttered, "My dentist." On Monday, August 29th, he told a visitor to his home that he still planned to participate when the court opened in October, but at that point there was nothing more his doctors could do for him. He died with his three children beside him in his townhouse in Arlington on the night of Saturday, September 3rd. The week before Rehnquist's death, starting on August 29th, Hurricane Katrina nearly demolished New Orleans and the surrounding area. The stumbling federal response to the crisis transformed the Bush presidency, including the selection of Supreme Court justices. The president didn't make it to the general vicinity of the damage until September 2nd, when he received a briefing at the airport in Mobile, Alabama. There, on that morning, Bush uttered one of the defining phrases of his presidency, "Brownie, you're doing a heck of a job," to the hapless director of the Federal Emergency Management Agency, Michael Brown. Even in the first few days after Katrina, it was clear that the White House needed any distraction from the calamity. Bush needed good news so badly that he acted with a degree of haste that was nearly disrespectful to Rehnquist. At 8:01 a.m. on September 5th, Labor Day, less than 48 hours after Rehnquist died, Bush summoned the news media to the Oval Office to announce that he was nominating Roberts to be the 17th Chief Justice of the United States. For the past 2 months, members of the United States Senate and the American people have learned about the career and character of Judge Roberts, Bush said. They like what they see. He's a gentleman. He's a man of integrity and fairness. The continuing fallout from the hurricane meant that Roberts' hearings received relatively little attention, especially since the outcome was a foregone conclusion. They began slightly later than originally planned because Roberts was now being considered for chief, not associate justice. In his opening statement, on September 12th, Roberts said, "A certain humility should characterize the judicial role. Judges and justices are servants of the law, not the other way around. Judges are like umpires. Umpires don't make the rules, they apply them. The role of an umpire and a judge is critical. They make sure everybody plays by the rules. But it is a limited role. Nobody ever went to a ball game to see the umpire." Roberts was right about the motivations of baseball fans, if not Supreme Court justices. In truth, unlike umpires, Supreme Court justices do make the rules, and their job amounts to far more than a mechanical process of applying them. As to how Roberts himself would apply the vague commands of the Constitution, he was careful not to commit himself. Under questioning from Arlen Specter, Roberts said that Roe v. Wade was settled as a precedent of the court, entitled to respect under principles of stare decisis. But he also pointed out that the justices sometimes reversed their own precedents. Roberts wouldn't say how he would vote on Roe. Like all other nominees, Roberts dodged making commitments, but his winning manner and broad erudition were manifest. He remembered the names of old cases with ease and summarized the arguments on a wide variety of constitutional controversies. He quoted the Federalist Papers from memory. Senator Dick Durbin, an Illinois Democrat, spoke for many when he said that Roberts retired the trophy for outstanding performance by a judicial nominee. On September 23rd, he was confirmed by the Judiciary Committee by a vote of 13-5. 6 days later, he was confirmed by the full Senate by a vote of 78-22. With the exception of the Roberts nomination, the summer brought only dismal news for the Bush administration. Earlier in 2005, Iraqis had staged their first free election since the war, and the voters' purple ink-stained fingers became symbols of a hopeful emerging democracy. But in the months that followed, chaos reigned, and dozens of American troops continued to die in Iraq each month. Also during this period, Bush's plan for including private accounts in the Social Security system crashed, scorned even by most Republicans. Finally, the overall federal response to Hurricane Katrina was widely viewed as indifferent at best and incompetent at worst. Bush's approval ratings plunged from around 60% favorable at the time of his reelection to about the same percentage unfavorable less than a year later. It was in this context that the president made his second appointment to the Supreme Court. His first choice to fill that slot was his White House counsel, Harriet Myers, and the selection proved disastrous. Myers was a loyal Bush supporter through and through, but she had few bona fides as a movement conservative, a failure that outraged Bush's base, evangelicals and right-wing intellectuals alike. Indeed, the outcry against her appointment grew so shrill that the embarrassed administration was forced to capitulate. On October 27th, Bush reluctantly accepted Meyer's withdrawal. The next day, Friday, October 28th, Louis Scooter Libby, the vice president's chief of staff, was indicted in the CIA leak investigation for perjury and obstruction of justice, ending perhaps the worst week of the Bush presidency. The Myers debacle and the Libby charges took place while the Gulf Coast remained in extremis and the Iraq disaster continued. Facing similar crises, other presidents had found refuge in moderation, in bipartisanship, in gestures of conciliation to political adversaries. But George W. Bush did not conduct that kind of presidency. Over the weekend, Harriet Myers, ever loyal even in the face of public humiliation, accompanied the president to Camp David to help choose a replacement for herself. Their goal remained unchanged, to select the most conservative possible Supreme Court justice, one who would be welcomed by the president's base. By 8:01 on Monday morning, they had their man.